say, Minkowski in a flat space metric. And in that approximation, we found that G00 can be identified with C squared plus twice phi, where phi is the Newtonian gravitational potential. We found that from looking at the motion, a geodesic motion in the field, in this weak field. So using that, now we're in a position to discuss the redshift and the corresponding slowing down or speeding up of clocks according to their location in a gravitational field. So now I'll make a further assumption that G mu nu, just which is realistic for something like the surface of the Earth, at least to a good approximation. I'll make a further simplification. We'll assume that G, that the metric components are stationary. In other words, independent of time. And that means that x0, which we also call t, represents a kind of global time, or what you might call universal time, which, as we saw, also known as killing time. That's the time that makes it manifest that nothing is changing, that essentially there's a symmetry of time translation for the field. And as we saw, I think, a couple of times ago, that means that this is, of course, not proper time, the relation being given by the formula that we always had, except with the c squared put in now, c squared d tau squared, which is, with this convention of signature that we're using for the metric, is minus ds squared, and that's, of course, equal to minus g00 dt squared. If we're talking about just time elapsed on a clock that's stationary in this field. So, in fact, I'll also use p and q. I'll use the symbol to represent spatial locations. In other words, in this coordinate system, it's designated values of the three spatial coordinates, x, k. Okay. So for a clock that's at rest, whose spatial coordinates are constant, we have, of course, this equation, the dxks are zero, and therefore taking the square root, we find that d tau is equal, since g0 is negative, that's the absolute value of g00 times dt squared. So taking the square root, we have the relation, simple relationship between proper time as shown on the clock at rest in this field and coordinate time dt. So in other words, proper time, so far there's no approximation here. So therefore, proper time advances more rapidly when the absolute value of g00 is bigger. So now consider, let's see what that works out in the case of the weak field. So consider some setup like this. This may be Earth. This be one location. Here's another location, say, at a higher altitude above the Earth. And consider a clock here and a clock here. Then we just saw, well, now we want to use the other thing that we saw last time, which was this. So near a, plugging that in, we get that d tau is now approximately equal to, so g0 divided, this is the absolute value of g00 is this, so dividing through by c squared, we get the absolute value of g00 of c squared is 1 plus 2 phi over c squared. Its square root is that. And of course, that's approximately to the same linear approximation equal to just 1 plus phi over c squared times dt, giving the relation between proper time and coordinate time. So notice that, interestingly enough, the 2 dropped out again. And so, therefore, the change in the Newtonian potential gives you basically just the relative change in the frequency, or in this case, the inverse frequency, in this case, the elapsed time on some clock. So near a Newtonian, near a spherical body, of course, we have that phi, the Newtonian potential, if it's a body of mass m, then it goes like minus gm over r or minus kappa m over 4 pi or 8 pi, sorry, r. Just to remind you the formula for the Newtonian potentials. The main thing is that the clock, so what this means is that the clock, the Newtonian potential, the point here is that the Newtonian potential is, of course, negative, just expressing the fact that gravity is attractive. And therefore, this 1 plus phi is less than 1. And so that means as you get deeper in the potential, this factor gets smaller in magnitude, and it means that t tau is advancing less rapidly than it is at higher altitude. So here, low down, the clock is slow, and high up, the clock is faster. So the conclusion is that near a massive body, clocks run slow. In fact, there's a, that's a very probably familiar to everyone. There's a kind of interesting question that I remember Bob Geroge raised a long time ago. And I know some work has been done on it, but I don't know actually whether it's been settled. And the question is, can you do something to make clocks run fast? I mean, clocks, here's something, you can make something to make the clock run slow. You lower it down near a gravitational potential. Everyone knows another thing you can do using the twin paradox. You can make the clock move rapidly and accelerate in some way, go in circles or something. That'll also slow it down. Is there some way to speed up a clock, some physically allowed technique? So I've just raised that question. It's an interesting one to think about. As I said, as far as I know, there are some results on it. I know Don Marolf had some results on it related of that, I mean, addressing some aspect of that. But I don't actually know what the current status of it is. But the conjecture would be that, in some sense, there you can't. That the only all the things you can do would actually slow the clock. There was one other point. What was it? Oh, I can't remember the other point that I had in mind. If I remember it, I'll come back to it. So anyway, this is the main conclusion so far, is that the rate of the clock with respect to universal time is influenced by its depth in the gravitational field. Then this can be related to the redshift by a nice thought experiment, Gedanken experiment, that I think might be familiar also, that we can run through. So imagine, so here's this was just a spatial picture here. Now imagine a space-time picture. And so this was the point P that was lower down. This was the point Q that was higher up. So vertical is now to the right. And imagine something emitting light or some sort of signal traveling at the speed of light, say light, and sending it up to the receiver at a higher altitude. So here's the emission event, and here's the absorption event. Now, so if you imagine emitting, say, a constant wave here, then you're going to receive, of course, a constant frequency wave here. And what we're interested in is the relation between the two frequencies. So, but instead of saying, the claim is that the two frequencies have to be equal when measured in this global time t in which the metric is stationary. One way of seeing that is, I mean, in a certain sense, that's the definition of constant frequency, but that would be a bit of a cheat. What we really mean is it's a fixed frequency locally. And so you could imagine, instead of a wave train, or instead of, you know, a sinusoidal wave, you could imagine a sequence of pulses, each at the maximum of the wave or something like that. And if you imagine a certain number of pulses are sent out per constant time delta, with a time lapse between them, say as delta t here, then they're going to be received at the same time lapse delta t, because if they didn't, then it would mean that they would bunch up or they would spread out, right? If they were received with a smaller delta t, then somehow you'd end up receiving more. So it's a very reasonable assumption for this Gedanken experiment that won't happen. And if that doesn't happen, then it means that delta t at location q is equal to delta t at location p. For some reason, I switched here from A to B. I'll try and keep it P and Q, but I might lapse back into A and B. So given that, and given the relation of the clocks, when we say that it's a certain frequency, when we're talking about the redshift, we're asking about the frequency as measured by local good clocks. So since we can relate the time of arrival in this way, we can therefore relate the frequencies. And the claim is, since they're equal, delta t of q, delta tau of q over delta tau, imagine these as infinitely fast, if you like, over delta tau of p, when we just saw that the tau is given by the ratio, the square root of g00, absolute value, so it'll be g00 of q over g00 of p, absolute value to the 1/2, and we just saw that those are equal to,
Well,
at least it wasn't false. Okay. So here I've used it. Here, I've used this, right? Yeah. So this is equal to 1 plus. We have the square root already. 1 plus phi over c squared at p, what shall I call it, phi q, over 1 plus phi of p over c squared. And that's approximately equal to that. And that's approximately equal to, of course, 1 plus phi of q minus phi of p over c squared. So that's the red at this approximation in which we can reliably identify this with, I mean, this part is exact, of course, but if we want to talk about a thought experiment in which we can relate it to things that are presumably already known pre-relativistically, then we use this weak field approximation and we get that. So the fractional, what it says, the fractional shift in the, this is the time lapse, so it's the inverse frequency. The fractional shift in the inverse frequency is just given by the difference in the gravitational potentials divided by c squared. So let me introduce the symbol delta to mean change, since I've already monopolized this capital delta to mean the time between pulses, or the inverse frequency, if you like, the period of the wave. So I'll introduce delta to mean the change from P to Q. And then what we've just seen is that delta omega over omega is equal, since the frequency is, since this was a period, it'll be given by minus delta, this is delta phi. Delta phi of Q minus phi of P. So this I could have written as 1 plus delta phi over C squared. And then delta, that's delta omega over omega is equal to minus, therefore, that delta phi over C squared, right? So that tells you that the frequency, that since phi increases as you go up in the gravitational potential or in the field of the Earth, this becomes negative. That tells you that the frequency is lessened, which is the same thing. If the clock is running fast, if the real clocks are running faster up here, then of course they'll see a given frequency as less when it's constant in terms of the coordinate time. So if they're running fast with respect to the coordinate time, they'll see a smaller frequency. So the light, left the equal sign out, minus delta phi over C squared. So this is just sort of almost trivial kinematics. What it tells you is that the modification in the rate of clocks in the gravitational field is essentially the same thing as the redshift in light that's transmitted back and forth between different locations in the gravitational field. So ascending light is redshifted. That's why, I don't know why it's called the gravitational redshift. It could have been called the blue shift, but apparently people had in mind ascending light. Maybe they were thinking of light from a star or something like that. You can't send it down. Well, I don't know. You can't, well, but you, on the other hand, if you have someone to receive it, someone has to be up there. They can send it down. I think the first such experiment, I don't know if it was actually the first, but a very early experiment of that form was done in a building at Harvard in the laboratory in Mallinckrodt, I think it was. And I don't actually know if the light was sent down or up, but I wouldn't guarantee that it was sent up. But I mean, they had something on one floor, an emitter and a receiver on the other floor, and measured the frequency shift. Anyway.
Sorry, so with the person who absorbs the light, see the change in frequency to be equal to the amount of work you would have to do in this?
Well, that's exactly the right, that's the question. So it's natural to think that the light is redshifted when it goes up because it's somehow losing energy. And if we think in terms of a photon, in order for its energy to go down, that means that its frequency has to go down. So the next question is, does it quantitatively agree with the amount of work that you would have to do? So that's exactly what we'll take up next.
It's redshifted compared to the person seeing it sees it redshifted. So the person who's higher up sees it as redshifted.
Yes. So imagine that you're just sitting here with you know nothing about this universal time coordinate, but you have a clock and you measure the frequency of this photon, and then you send it up, you let it go up, and then someone else is sitting up on the ceiling with their clock and measuring the frequency of the photon in the same way, then the claim is that they'll get a lower frequency, and it's by this amount. Yeah.
So I can understand the conclusion that the ratio of the proper time change under the assumption that the coordinate time is the same. But right. I still missed what is the physical reason why should we assume that in the coordinate time
that the frequencies are equal?
Okay, first of all, why do you call it frequency? And second, why has it to be the same? That I missed.
Well, here I considered, I call it frequency just because I don't know what else to call it. I mean, we're thinking of something that's going to sine omega t or something like that.
It's a coordinate difference.
We're imagining a wave which has the behavior of sine omega t or something like that, or which is, of course, also sine of omega prime tau for some other omega. I mean, since the two are strictly proportional. But I'm imagining it to have a frequency of sine omega t here. And then the claim is that when it's received up here, it'll have the same frequency, whatever, let's just call this omega naught.
Yes, that's the assumption.
That's the assumption. Now the question, yeah, so that, but you first, you asked why I called it frequency. Okay. I wasn't sure what that question was asking about. And then, so you imagine the way, this is the, we're sending the wave this way, right? So at any given moment in universal time, there should be a certain number of wavelengths between here and here, whatever it may be. And at a later moment, there should be the same number, if it's really a steady state. Right? So if there's the same number of wavelengths between here and here at one time, and then much later there's the same number of wavelengths also, it must be that the same number of wavelengths that left here, that moved past here, also moved past here. Otherwise, you'd get a bunching up. If the frequency in this global time were greater here, then you later on you would see, you know, far more waves. And if it was smaller here, later on you'd see that it stretched out the other way. So if you assume that here's the assumption that you can set up a stationary situation by sending out a
a signal, means, you move up the,
means that if you move
to a time-like direction,
that's right.
Then it's always the same pattern.
Yes.
But what happens if you move it left and right, or up and down in the spatial direction? That's if you move it from P to Q.
This was P and this was Q.
Yes. So stationary is with regard to up and down on your.
It's regard to time, yeah, up and down in this picture.
And now you want to give an argument left and right in a spatial direction. So why shall there be no squeezing?
Well, then it won't be a stationary situation, that's all. Well, if it's some early time, if you imagine this, suppose you set up this oscillator and it's sending out signals and you let everything settle down and just does that forever, then the claim is that if I go and I look in a year and I look in 2 years, I should see the same situation. Nothing should have changed. And so that means the number of wavelengths between here and here should not have changed. Once you accept that, if you accept that, then the rest follows.
Right? Yeah, okay.
Then it must mean that, then it must. But, I mean, so it's a thought experiment. So I think you can challenge anything you like. Since if you're making a new theory, you can always challenge anything in the old theory. But this would be a very hard thing to disbelieve, right? It'd be a very hard thing to disbelieve that I set up an oscillator here and I just let it go for a long time, and that there's a secular change in the situation. In other words, a change that accumulates with time in the situation. That's what the word secular means. A more correct answer, once we have the theory, which we do have the theory, would be to write down the wave equation and then just prove this fact. But we haven't written the wave equation. Or even better, write down Maxwell's equation, since we're dealing with light. But either one would do. Then we would be able to prove this fact. We would just look for solutions of the wave. So just as an aside, the wave equation is this. This is the D'Alembertian, which you probably know. We could look for a solution that goes like e to the I omega naught t, and we would find a solution in which the spatial situation is constant. Spatial wave is just a constant plane wave, and in which it does have, in fact, this harmonic time dependence with respect to the coordinate time t. Yeah.
I think if we have a small curvature compared to the wavelength, then we can have we can plot this diagram for the small distances. If we take t and q very small,
yes.
And then this then the coordinate, we can take the coordinate of the P to measure the duration of time at Q. So these two are equal. So locally, it's like a flat space time. So it's like a
well, local.
We mean Minkowski space. I mean.
Yes.
And then we integrate it to the
Yeah, as it was mentioned last time, you could actually derive the redshift and maybe even I'll make it a homework. But you could derive the redshift from the equivalence principle as long as the field is weak. Yeah, that's true. That's what you're saying. But I didn't want to use the equivalence principle. I want to use an argument which is valid more generally, because this redshift, this is true even if you're when we go away from this linearized approximation, this is true exactly. This is a true equality. And so you should be, you and can measure that, right? I mean, so if you're near a black hole or something like that, or some very deep potential well, you still have the same relationship. But you're right, you could do it.
Once we say the clocks slow down, then it's an equivalent statement, because this is, after all, any periodic event is a clock. So,
only a local thing. So if you send signals back and forth like this, you could use that as a clock. And then then it would be certainly true that the rate of if you could somehow calibrate the same, use the same clock, namely use the same distance between those two, send something the same rigid rod or something, and then use it to form the clock. It's certainly true that the clock would run slower here with respect to the global time. However, I'm not sure, at least I don't see that from that you can derive what happens when you let the light propagate from one place to another. Maybe you could by imagining a sequence of clocks, you know, sort of filling it up with clocks and noticing the small change. That would be a little bit along the lines that you were saying. So maybe, I'm not sure. There may be other arguments, other ways of seeing this. But this is perhaps, at least to me, the simplest convincing form of the argument. But anyway, this is a thought experiment. So as I said, so really what you want to see is that a bunch of assumptions that you're making, I mean, we don't have to do a thought experiment now. As I said, to analyze the situation, because we know the exact equations that govern it. But of course, when you're trying to build a theory, it's important to do these kind of experiments to see whether you've come up with a consistent set of ideas. And it's certainly useful for getting a physical understanding of what the theory means. Okay, so everyone's happy, I hope, now with this assumption or this connection between the redshift and the different rate at which clocks run in the gravitation. Some, I hope everyone, at least N minus one people, are happy with this connection. So now, let's the question that you asked about energy conservation. Let's see if we can relate it to that. So consider the same process here, back in this picture. So now we imagine a photon emitted here. But let's consider exactly the question you asked, which was about the whether the work done is the right amount to account for the change in the frequency. So now I'm going to make an assumption which seems, I think, should be superfluous, which is I'm going to assume we're working with a photon. In other words, I'm going to bring in quantum mechanics. There ought not really to be any need for quantum mechanics. But I'm not sure. Well, I think I sort of know what it's doing for us, but I'm not sure enough, confident enough to tell you for sure. And anyway, it's a very interesting question. So I leave it to you to think about whether the argument I'm about to do I could run without using the H bar at all. Okay, so of course, not using H bar, what I mean is that I'm going to use the relationship that E is equal to H bar omega for the photon. So now we'll imagine sending up just a single photon, and imagine that it goes up a height h. And let's track the energy conservation. If the energy conservation doesn't work out, then you ought to be able to design a perpetual motion machine. You know, if it doesn't work, you could imagine a process in which you end up gaining a net amount, a periodic process in which you end up gaining a net amount of energy. So how would that be? So maybe I'll draw it again to unclutter the picture. So let's start out now with, for example, up above, with a photon of frequency omega. Let's see, how do I want to do this? So that's locally, so that's local frequency. I mean the true frequency omega with respect to a clock here. Now imagine lowering it down, say in a box. If we do so that's the first step of the process. The second step of the process will be to let the photon out and let it climb back up by itself. So we'll end up with a photon up here. Now, in lowering the photon down, we put it in a box and we've lowered it down. So in lowering it down, it has a weight, and so it's giving us, we're getting work out, right, from that lowering the photon down. How much work did we get? The first question is, what happens to the frequency, to the local frequency of the photon? So the first claim is, so in step one, step two is here, where we let it go back up. In step one, I claim that the locally measured frequency is constant. Now, how do we see that? In step two, of course, we just saw there's a redshift and the frequency will get smaller. So why do I say that the locally measured frequency, if I've put this in a box and lowered it down, is constant? So I think there are probably different arguments that could lead to the same thing. So I should have said, I imagine it lowering it adiabatically. So in other words, very, very infinitely slowly lowering it down. The one argument is the adiabatic theorem, which you know, that if we just imagine ourselves riding with the box, we're seeing something, say the photon is some wave inside the box, it's in the ground state, there's some mirrors and so on. Then we know that it's going to remain in its ground state, and that means that its frequency will also, its wavelength will remain constant, measured in proper units, local proper distance, and therefore its frequency will also remain the same. Okay, so that's one argument. Another argument, maybe you can think of a third, but let me give you a second argument, is if you don't like that one, let's instead of leaving the photon in the box and lowering the box, let's convert it into, imagine it's just the right size photon, we convert it into an electron-positron pair. Then we lower this electron-positron pair down, then we re-annihilate them and make a photon. Well, it's the same electron in the same, electron in every one place is the same as an electron anywhere else, so we ought to get the same energy and therefore the same frequency. Okay, so there's another argument. Maybe there are other arguments. But the assumption is that the locally measured, the thing we use now in this argument is that the locally measured frequency is constant. In the second stage, it flies back up, and then it goes to, we saw that the locally measured frequency, since it stayed, it was still omega when it got down here, it then goes to omega minus delta omega, where we can compute a delta omega up in that formula. Okay, so the overall effect of this process is that omega goes to omega minus delta omega. Okay, that's the first step. So we have this photon, we lower it down, we get work out, let it fly back up, we have another photon, it's redder, and then the question is it redder by the right amount? Has it lost the right amount of energy to compensate the work that we got out by lowering it down. Okay. So that's the question. Is the work extracted? Is it equal to the reduction in the photon energy? It's just a symbol for a photon. So what is the reduction in the photon energy? That's delta of, since H bar, here's another assumption, H bar is not changing. So the energy is H bar omega. So the reduction in the energy is just H bar times the change, or the change in the energy is H bar times the change in omega. Now, what about on this side? How much is the work extracted? Well, now I'll make another assumption. I'll assume that the photon just acts like, gives a mass. You know, we'll use the E equals mc squared formula for the photon's mass. I'll call that m. And we'll assume that in lowering it down, it exerts the gravitational force that you would expect from that mass. If you don't like that, imagine that we first converted into electron and a positron, just two massive particles in the normal sense, and then we know that their weight should be whatever is given by this expression, where m is e over c squared. So the question is, are these equal? Well, we just said that m was h bar omega over c squared. Is it equal to, at least approximately equal to, h bar delta omega? So h bar, so this is why you might think you never needed h bar, it drops out. So the question is it true that delta omega is over omega? Well, is this true? If we divide it through, then it says a trivial algebra. It just says delta phi over c squared is approximately equal to delta omega over omega. But that was the formula that we had there up to a sign. I seem to have got, if I trace something somewhere, oh, the work extracted is, that would make the work negative, right? Because phi is greater higher up, so I better call the work extracted here. Okay. So indeed, they agree. So that's a very nice, if you're trying to create the theory, it's a very nice hint that you're on the right track with these concepts. Conversely, if you believe this argument, then you would be able to conclude to the extent that this is a conclusive, convincing argument, you would be able to conclude that energy conservation must imply the redshift, right? If we just read this argument backward, and then we just saw before that the redshift applies, in fact, it's the same thing as the slowing of modulo. I shouldn't say the same thing, but modulo one dot, it's the same thing as the slowing of clocks. So this is an argument that shows you that the gravitational field must have some influence on geometry involving things like measurement of proper time, if you want a consistent notion of energy conservation. So it's another way of seeing why one would expect, once you know quantum mechanics, and here, as I say, I'm not sure whether we really needed to know quantum mechanics for this argument, but certainly, once you know it, then you can sort of see that there has to be something like a redshift, completely independent of things like the equivalence principle. So therefore, gravity. You already see that there's this is another way of seeing that there's some connection between gravity and geometry. The geometry, that's just short for the metric tensor, GAB, of course, in this situation. Then as pointed out, someone pointed out once or twice already, You could also get this result from the equivalence principle, and so that's another nice consistency of the theory. So that's all I wanted to say about the redshift in general. And then I think it might be fun to apply it to another interesting thought experiment that apparently was important historically, which I'll mention in a second. But is there any question, more questions on this, what we just did? Okay, so I thought it would be fun to look at the connection between this, or to apply what we just learned to this delta E, delta T thought experiment, which I've recently come to doubt whether we really know the historical story. So the story behind this is that there was some meeting in Brussels and Einstein was trying to argue against quantum mechanics, which he didn't like, and that he laid down this challenge to say that that you could violate the delta T, delta E uncertainty principle if you took gravity into account, and then quantum mechanics would be inconsistent. And then Bohr and other people tried to answer, and they all got together and thought it out, and they found out that there was actually a flaw in the original. So it was supposed to be this big showdown. But then recently, I think, was it Anthony Valentini and a co-author wrote a book on this conference. And they I mean, they got a hold of the proceedings of this conference, and they wrote a whole book about it. And apparently they could find nowhere in the proceedings any reference to this whole debate. So if it happened, it happened sort of off camera or something like that. So I'm no longer sure whether the story, which I learned from reading a book by an article by Bohr, I'm no longer sure whether he was telling the truth, or let's say whether he was remembering correctly the story. I doubt he completely fabricated it, but what the exact situation is, I don't know. Nevertheless, it's a very interesting question. Let's look at a place where we could, there's a suggestion here of a kind of experiment where you, at first sight, might imagine that you could violate this delta E, delta T uncertainty relation. And the thing which saves you is precisely this gravitational redshift. So here's the picture of the experiment. So what we're doing in a certain sense is producing a kind of unstable system. And you know, for an unstable system, this delta E delta T uncertainty relationship is much harder to state in a precise form than the delta P delta Q one. But one thing that it certainly means that you're familiar with is that there's a relation between lifetime of an unstable state and line width of an unstable state, right? The line width, the variation in E, the uncertainty. This delta here now means uncertainty or spread or something like that, fuzziness. It doesn't mean change in the energy now. It means standard deviation in energy, something like that. So delta E, delta T, could be thought of as like in that way. More generally, that's a special case of some more general statement, which is that any process that does something at all in a time delta T, I mean, if it really does something besides just sitting there and doing nothing, and if that something happens in a time T, some change takes place in a time delta T, then the spread in the energy of the wave function must be at least delta E, given by that. It's just Fourier analysis, right? If you have something that's varying with time as a pure sine wave, then nothing ever changes. Quantum mechanically, literally nothing changes because it's just a phase. And so if you're going to make something change in a time delta T, you need a superposition of different frequencies. And this is the expression of that fact. So now let's think let's carry this over. That's kind of mathematical argument. Let's carry this over. I didn't draw this big enough. So what's going to happen, this something that's going to happen is we have a little clock in here, which I don't know how to draw. This doesn't look much like a clock. How do we draw it? Oh, here. Okay. Well, imagine that as a clock. It's reading 12:15 or something. So the point is, it's a self-contained sealed system. It has a clock and it has a door, which can be opened or closed. And there's a photon inside. And then at a certain time, as measured by this, the clock is set, it'll open the door and the photon will go out. So we'll make a transition from having the photon inside to having the photon outside. So it's as if this particle decayed, emitting a photon, turned in, you know, this box with photon turned into a box without photon plus photon. So some decay took place. And suppose, so we expect, therefore, the line width, that is the uncertainty in the energy of this to be, if we think in that terms, then this can be called line width, to be related to the uncertainty in the time at which this happens by that relationship. Now, the challenge was, well, we can reduce, let's suppose we set this up, we can reduce delta, we can actually reduce delta, so it's claimed, we can reduce delta E to zero by weighing the clock, weighing this box before and after. That's actually why I put it on this spring, because we're going to use that spring to weigh it. And we have some scale here. We use that. But doesn't matter how you weigh it in this abstract challenge. So the kind of, we weigh it before and after, and since we know how much its weight has changed, we know exactly how much energy has been lost. But then, in the same time, we have this. We set this clock, and this can be an arbitrarily accurate clock, and so we can know the exact time at which the door was opened and the photon was released. So this transition took place at a very precise time. We don't have to worry about the time it takes the photon to fly out. We could imagine reducing that as much as we want. So we know, the claim is, we know both the time and we know the exact energy released, energy of the decay product. So what's wrong with that? Maybe I should write it. Well, okay, so I gave away, so you might think how you get around this. But one obvious source of delta T is, I mean, we said that delta T was as small as we like, but that's only true if we know the height of the clock exactly as we want. But if we know the height of the clock very precisely, then we can't weigh it, right? Because the only way you can weigh it is to release it, let it bounce around a little bit, and there'll be some uncertain, there'll be some indefinite, there'll be some unavoidable bouncing around because of the uncertainty principle, or the PQ uncertainty principle. If you know the height exactly, then it means the momentum is completely indefinite in the vertical direction, and look, this box will be flying all over the place. So if you want it to be approximately staying at a fixed location so that you can read this, then it has to have some spread in the in its delta Q, or delta whatever I call this. If I call the height Q, you can't, if it has, you know, if you make delta Q too small, then you can't weigh it. And if you make delta P too small, then you won't know where it is. So there's the germ of an answer. Now let's see if the answer is if we can turn that into a derivation of the uncertainty relation in this case. So I'll call the height Q now. Now we just. And the clock speed depends on that. And I'll let T be the time that we use to weigh it. And now, while we're weighing it, its height is going to be uncertain, and therefore the rate at which the clock is running is going to be uncertain, and that's going to introduce a delta t. And if we don't weigh it precisely enough, that will introduce a delta e, right? Because the whole point was to learn e by weighing it. So let's remember the clock rate. We had the formula. Did we have the clock rate? Is 1 plus, well, I'll write it again, I can't see it there. We know that the rate of the clock is proportional to 1 plus pi over c squared. And now we're in a constant gravitational field at this approximation. So phi is just equal to, why haven't I written this down? Anyway, we know phi is equal to gh, but that's gq. Try and get my notation straight. Okay, so let's see, what's the uncertainty in the time that results from that? The weighing process, which we had to weigh before and after, but let's just think of one of them. So the weighing process absorbs some time t, whatever it may be. And so during that time, it has some uncertainty in the gravitational potential. And so the uncertainty in the elapsed time is equal to this, by the formula that we had before. And just, I can rewrite that as t over c squared. And then what's here, that's right. So what is the uncertainty in phi? It's given by the uncertainty in height times delta phi delta height. Right. And delta phi delta q, the change in the gravitational potential with height, is just equal to the acceleration of gravity. So that's equal to t over c squared times g, the acceleration of gravity, times delta q. Right? So this is this, whatever it is that everyone learns that I can never remember because they start using meters. But what is it? 9 something times 9.8 something. Anyway, this is the 9.8 or something, meters per second squared or something like that. Okay, so using MKS instead of CGS. So anyway, so this is I can't even remember it in CGS now, but anyway, that's the acceleration of gravity at the Earth's surface. So that's our first equation. So delta, putting it together, delta T is about equal in order of magnitude to g over c squared times capital T, the time it took to do the weighing. That's, of course, under our control to some extent. We can allocate more or less time to do the weighing, but we can't make it arbitrarily short. Now, why can we not make it arbitrarily short? So suppose we want an accuracy of delta m in the mass that we weigh. I claim, so I'll give two arguments for this. The reason for giving two arguments is obviously I think that neither one is 100% conclusive, that maybe you can be convinced. But I'll give the second one if there's time, but the first argument is simpler. So if we want to distinguish m from, that means accuracy delta m, that means we want to distinguish m from m plus delta m. The claim is that we need to wait long enough for this difference delta m to have produced an acceleration produced of, through the acceleration of gravity to produce a momentum which is greater than the uncertainty in momentum that this object has. If you see what I mean. In other words, so the claim is that we need. So what is it? This is the momentum, this is the force, mg, on this box, and t is the amount of time that the force is acting, the gravitational force that's always there, and that's producing a certain amount of momentum. If we want to see, for example, we have to know whether the box is at rest on average in order to say that we've weighed it correctly. You just can't look where the pointer is and then the box flies around. You have to let the scale settle down always to see. So the claim is that the settling down time has to be at least as great as the uncertainty in the momentum of the box itself. If the box had a wildly uncertain momentum and the gravitational field only gave it a tiny momentum during that time, then it's pretty intuitive that you wouldn't be able to successfully complete the weighing process. Then the relevant amount, of course, is the difference in mass, because that's, you want the accuracy to be such that you can see that difference. So hopefully that's convincing. If we believe that, then we can work out the uncertainty in the energy. It's just equal to the uncertainty in the mass times c squared, and the claim is, did I write? I think I wrote, I don't, yeah, I had in my notes right, but I didn't write it right here. It's g times delta m times t should exceed delta p. And so this says, what this says is that delta m should be greater than delta p over gt. So delta m c squared should be greater than, in order of magnitude of greater or equal to than the c squared over gt times delta p. Okay. So this is that's equation one. And if you buy this argument, that's equation two. Now, from this, if you accept both of these equations, then it becomes simple. We just multiply them together. Delta E delta T is then greater than, in order of magnitude, greater than or equal to G over C squared times T times delta Q times C squared over GT times delta P. Okay, so the C squareds go out, G goes out, and T goes out. And so that's just equal to delta Q, delta P. So what we've done is we've related the energy time uncertainty relation to the position momentum uncertainty relation. And so if we believe that, then of course, you need an input somewhere. So that's greater than the order of h bar. Yeah. Which one? This one?
This
one. Yes.
So how do you work this one? Is it because of the energy, the photon release from the button?
No, it's because the clock. So the time is being measured by this clock, and the clock, this is a closed system, supposed to be a closed system, and there's no external clock. So otherwise the external clock might exchange energy with this, and then you'd have to monitor that. So we don't want that exchange of energy. So this clock is the one that determines when the door is opened. But the clock will run at a different rate depending on how high it is in the field. And the claim is that during the weighing process, which most both precede and follow this experiment, let's look at the one preceding it, if that suffices. During the one weighing that precedes it, the height of the clock must be uncertain. And since the height of the clock is uncertain, the amount of time that it will elapse on it is also uncertain. The amount of our time, from the external time.
But this happens once the photon is released from the box.
No. No, it oscillates. No, the question is, how do you weigh something? So you have to sort of, you have to clamp it down, but not too tight, right? If you clamped it down too tight, because of the uncertainty principle, as soon as you released it, it'll start flying around. So you have to sort of clamp it down in a kind of loose way, and then you have to let it free. I mean, that first part is just so you don't start with some crazy, highly stretched initial condition where it starts flying around. So you want to put it somewhere near where the equilibrium point would be, then release it, and then watch it and see that it has, in fact, come into equilibrium. And the claim is that that process of watching it to see whether it has come into equilibrium has to take a time, some finite time t, which is, if you believe my argument here, is given by, has to be at least as big as delta p over g delta m, where delta m is the accuracy you want. So during that, it's just during that time of letting it, of watching it and verifying that it's actually correctly weighed, some uncertainty in the clock reading accumulates. But of course, delta q has what do I want to say? No, I think that's all I need to say, I think. I mean, if you were to analyze the way, the second argument I was going to do was to analyze the weighing process more correctly, and we would reach a similar conclusion. It's obvious because you need, to the extent that there's an uncertainty in the height, you obviously will get an uncertainty in the weight, given proportional to the acceleration of gravity. But I think maybe, well, we could do the second argument. Maybe I'll put it off for now because I wanted to make a start on the discussion of tensors. But so is the argument clear, roughly? Maybe. During the process of weighing, an uncertainty in the reading of the clock relative to the external clock will accumulate. And because that time of weighing is not arbitrarily short, what it depends, according to this, what it depends on is the uncertainty in the momentum. The more you reduce the uncertainty in the momentum, the shorter you can make the time. But then, of course, because of the uncertainty principle, then the uncertainty in the height will become greater, and the confusion in the elapsed time will not go down. That's the idea. The role of the photon? Oh, it's just to make a nice story. It's just something, it doesn't really have to be, it just needs to do, it could be anything really. It's just to make a nice analogy. I mean, this is how the story was written down by Bohr, but I don't know that it plays an essential role. But it makes a nice analogy with the decay of an unstable particle. The real statement is that a box like this, I mean, that's a good question. Yeah, the photon is not really essential. The real statement is that some process that is made to happen at a definite time cannot happen in a system whose energy is more definite than delta T, where delta E and delta T are related by this. Was that another question? No. Okay. I'm debating whether to give this other. So, well, why don't I let you think, those who are interested, think about it. See if you believe this argument that I gave here, this inequality, this half of the, if you can come up maybe with a better proof of it or a better demonstration than what I just gave. On the other hand, if you don't believe this, can you come up with some other argument that would lead to the same result in the end? I claim I did work out such another one in which we thought of this as a harmonic, this box here as a harmonic oscillator. And we used, let's see, what exactly? We used the fact that in order for the weighing process to complete, this oscillator should go through at least one full oscillation. And if you don't wait long enough to see that it stops going down and bounces up and is going back and forth about some equilibrium location, then you really haven't, you can't be sure what you found. So if you put that as the concern, if you actually model this as a quantum harmonic oscillator, and you put that constraint that the weighing process should last long enough to see one oscillation, you can derive the same inequality without directly making this assumption. So that's an, I leave that also for you to to play with. So if someone wants to raise it next time and is still interested, I can show you that argument with a harmonic oscillator. But maybe for now, I'll just leave it as a, something to think about. So that's about, we've got a lot of interesting physics out without having gone too much, without having to do too much differential geometry. But there's obviously a limit to how much you can do. So the next thing we have to do is some more differential geometry, more mathematics. And so we'll have to develop some of the basic concepts when we want to write down, even when we want to talk about energy conservation, when we talk about motion and the Schwarzschild metric and so on, the perihelion precession of Mercury and all those things. We already need to do this, and certainly when we want to write down the Einstein equations, when we write down the action principle for them in particular, we'll need the notion of curvature, and that's really differential. For that, we need more mathematics, what you might call tensor analysis or differential geometry. So the next sort of little period will be developing those things. First of all, and that'll be kind of in two parts. First of all, we'll do that, the algebraic aspect, because it's probably not fair to assume that everyone knows, even at an algebraic level, what a tensor really is or how to work with tensors. So that's the first topic. And then the second thing, of course, is how to differentiate tensors or tensor fields, how to compare tensors at different points in a manifold. That's the second part of the story, which is the sort of analysis part of the story. So the first part is really just about tensors themselves and related things. So what is a tensor? So I've given you these notes. Which you can read more or less what I'm going to tell you now, maybe in a slightly different order. Maybe I could ask, or just like maybe for three people to say, how have you seen tensor defined?
I've seen it defined in a few ways.
Okay, name one.
One way is how it transforms, and one way I've seen it is as a function that brings a set of vectors to
Okay, okay, that's two.
That was pretty much what I was.
The same two. Has anyone seen a third? No. Okay, so I'll give you a list of about six or seven. Those two will be on the list, but it's not the one that is going to be our main definition. But the fact that there are so many different ways of thinking about tensor obviously is one of the things that makes it useful. So it's not like one has to be better than the other. On the other hand, I think some bring out, if you start with them, they bring out more clearly the essence of the idea. So here's what I would give as the most fundamental meaning of a tensor. It's a sum of products of vectors. And in the case of this kind of tensors we'll be thinking of in a manifold, I should say, and covectors, since we make that distinction. But I, for now, I'll just not worry about the distinction. So it's a sum of terms like that. So tensor is a sum of products of vectors and covectors. You can also think of it, this is obviously a circular definition, but it's one of its, so it wouldn't be a real definition, but it's, at least without, not without a little more work, it's just, but you can think of it as a linear operator from one space of tensors to another. You can think of it as this, which was mentioned twice just now. It's a multilinear form or function from vectors to n, here I better say explicitly, covectors to scalars. It's a certain type of geometrical object. We've seen some examples for that. What kind of geometrical object it is depends on which tensor you're talking about. Here's the first one that was mentioned. It's an array of numbers that transforms. It's an array of numbers also called the components of the tensor. That transforms in a certain way, to be specified, of course, when you change the basis, under change of basis. So what I really should say when I say it's an array of numbers, it's an array of numbers given relative to a choice of basis, which could be often a coordinate chart. So given a basis, you get a bunch of numbers, and it transforms in a certain way when you change the basis. Here's a very fancy one that no one mentioned. So it's an element of a vector space, which is called here we're dealing with tensors that are made by multiplying together vectors from V1 in some possibly different space, V2, and then forming a sum like this. I won't say more than just to mention this, but it arises, if you use this definition, it does simplify some of the proofs and makes it easier to see that certain things are well defined, but it arises as a solution of a so-called universal mapping problem. This is the sort of category theory way of thinking about a tensor. And then the final one, which is, it's a symbol decorated with some indices. Okay, that's, which is not 100% of a joke, but it's, but maybe it's 70% of a joke. But it's related to this notion of abstract index, which we'll be using. The ones that'll be most important to us, this one will sort of make our definition. This one will be very important, that because the converse of this, that any linear map from one space of tensors to another space of tensors is itself a tensor. That's how it will be important. And then this one, of course, because of the weight of tradition, this one also will be one of the important definitions.
That last definition, it seems to be not exclusive to dentists.
I guess you could say that. Yes.
By that definition, other things that are dentists can be dentists.
Yeah, almost anything. Yeah, so so here I don't assert the converse. I don't assert that any symbol with some indices is a tensor. But okay, so now in a little bit, I want to say a little, I make this notation precise. We've just introduced some sort of we've introduced some sort of symbol which is called tensor product. It's also sometimes called outer product, as opposed to inner product, which takes two objects and gives you a scalar. This gives you a new thing, a tensor. Basically, I mean, you might say we'd like to define, we should really proceed by defining this operation. But in some sense, you can't do it. In some sense, it's just an operation that we invent and we give it certain properties. It's just that we'd like to multiply tensors so we vectors, so we allow ourselves to do it. In the general case, that's right. So this. Had this, had U and V both, had there be just two, and U and V both belong to the same vector space, which will be for us usually the tangent space to a manifold, this would belong to what's called V tensor V. However, if V had belonged to the dual space, which we're about to define, then this would have belonged to that space of tensors. And in general, you can keep going and put any number of spaces. But I'll be a little more careful about saying this in a second. Yeah.
A quick question about the tensor product. When we tensor two vectors, we usually end up getting a tensor with that almost quote unquote equivalent to a matrix. And yet, in quantum, when we use the tensor product, we tend to have two vectors and we create a new longer vector.
I'm not sure why, not necessarily longer, I wouldn't say that, but you create an element of a new vector space. Like, say, if you have two spin and halves and you regard that as a combined system, then if it's like spin up here and spin x here and you tensor those together, that creates a combined state. It's not necessarily longer, but it's in a bigger tensor space. It started off in two dimensions, and then when you product them together, as we'll see, the dimension of the tensor product space is the product of the dimensions, as you must know from quantum mechanics, of course. Just put that off. Hopefully it will become clear when I give the precise definitions. Okay. The reason I'm putting it off is that the most important spaces for us will be V, which I'll be calling V, which will be basically the tangent space to the tangent space to the manifold at a given point P, one particular tangent. That'll be one of our vector spaces. But then, equally important, there'll be another space, which is the dual space, which I'm about to define. And then all the tensors, if not all, almost all or all the tensors that will arise in relativity will be made from products of vectors in this and in this. These, in the index notation, as we'll see, this corresponds to contravariant or upstairs indices, and this corresponds to covariant or downstairs indices. So when you see a tensor with a bunch of indices, some raised, some lowered, that's telling you how many factors of V occurred in forming it and how many factors of V star. So we'll have to do a little remedial work and talk about the dual vector space, which we didn't ever define. We defined the tangent space, but not the cotangent space. So we have to define the notion of covector. Then having done that, then we can define the kind of tensors and the generality that we need. I guess. Okay. So let me see if we can do this. So the definition of a covector, as I think everyone has probably seen, at least at some point, also known as a dual vector, is that it's an element of the space V star, which in turn is defined as the space of all linear maps from V to R. So we can, I'll call it, for now I'll try and keep a notational distinction between vectors and dual vectors, but maybe I won't fully keep it, but I'll try to use Greek letters for the covectors. So this is a linear map from the vector space into the reals, oops, such that omega is linear. In other words, a covector is a linear map from the vectors into the reals. This means that you can define that there's a notion, just by definition, there's a notion of inner product that'll take a vector and a covector and give you a scalar. It's just applying the covector to the vector. So basically, if this pair is omega and v, we want to make the inner product between this covector and this vector. We do it just by applying omega to v. There are different notations for this. We can say omega of v. We can just say omega dot v. That's often used. Or we can just make a more neutral notation like this. Looks just to put together omega and v. And you can even write it in the other order in this case. This one emphasizes that there's a kind of duality between, in the end it turns out it doesn't really matter if you start with the omegas and you get the v's as the linear maps, or you get the v, start with the v's and get the omegas. Maybe I'll start with mentioning that next time, but let me finish just by giving a picture. Remember, at various times I've tried to claim, to emphasize that it's always possible to think of any geometrical object in a pictorial way. And a covector is definitely a pictorial object. So how do we think of it? So let this be the tangent space to some manifold at P. So with respect to that vector space, the zero vector represents the point P, if you like. Then we know, so this could be V equals tangent space to the manifold at the point P. We know that a vector then is basically just given by a second point in that tangent space. Or if you like, it's given by the arrow that goes from the origin to that other point. If we want to picture in this same tangent space, if we want to picture a covector, how would we picture it? So this was picturing a vector in the vector space. How would we picture a covector space? The answer is, well, here's the origin again. You picture it, instead of by an arrow going through, originating at the origin, you picture it by a plane that doesn't actually go through the origin. And if you like, so this is a codimension one, a hyperplane, so this will be a dimension three plane. I'll just draw it as a line, thinking of one of two dimensions here, one plus one dimension. And you can think, if you like, it's nice to also draw the parallel plane through the origin. So it's a pair of planes. And if you like even more, you can just keep going. So it looks like a sort of foliation or partial foliation. I don't know what to call this, but a stack of parallel planes. That represents a covector. And how does it represent a covector? Well, it represents a covector in the following way, that if V is a vector, I'll call this omega, or what shall I call this plane? If V, I'll call it omega, but I mean this plane. So if V, so it means that omega V equals one if and only if the head of V, that is V itself, falls on, maybe I'll call it the head of omega. I'm not coming up with a very good terminology, but what it means, there's this plane here, and there's this V, this vector here. If the vector fits exactly in the stack of planes between two of them, then omega applied to V is one. If it fits halfway, if it's only, more generally, when V doesn't exactly fit between them, you just count off the number of planes it pierces, and that's omega V. So omega V is number of planes pierced by the vector V. So what we've done here is take the locus of all points in the vector space such that omega V equals one. Remember, we used that to talk about, to represent a metric tensor, for example, by taking the locus of all points in Minkowski space in which the GAB, VAVB, the norm squared of the point in Minkowski space equals one. So this is essentially the same trick used again, but in any case, it shows you more clearly in this case, not only how you can recover the vector, but it shows you how you can find the length. It shows you how you can find what it means geometrically to apply a covector to a vector or vice versa. It shows you what this inner product means. We'll also see when we come to discuss gradient that you could think, well, I'll come back to this, say it again, but you could think of these as the lines of constant height of a gradient of some height field or some field. You'll see why it becomes natural to think of a covector in terms of a bunch of parallel lines when we come to the particular kind of covector that's a gradient of a scalar field. Anyway, you can try and convince yourself. So if you like, it's an interesting exercise to see what would be the sum of two covectors in this geometrical picture, for example. That I'll leave that to you. Yeah.
So what decides the spacing between the planes? It is the gradient that decides.
Well, this is the covector itself. So yeah, I should have mentioned that. So if I draw a different spacing, that's a different covector. Or and if I draw a different orientation, that's also a different covector. But what's worth mentioning is what it means to double the vector. So because that's counterintuitive unless you think of gradient. To make the vector, if this is V, then 2V is longer. This is 2V, right? But if I ask if this, say, is omega, what is 2 omega? It's actually doubling the density of the thing. So making the covector bigger is actually bringing the two planes closer together. So the one thing that I can't represent very nicely in this picture is the zero covector, because that would have the planes infinitely far apart. So now you might ask yourself, what's the sum of these two covectors? If you think about it geometrically, there's only one thing you could really draw, and that turns out to be the right thing. But I'll leave that. I'll leave that forever. Well, or certainly for next time anyway. So any questions before we break? Did everyone who brought a homework hand it in? Okay.